Hello and welcome to this programme in the series looking at four decades of the Chamber Orchestra of Europe. I'm Simon Mundy, and in this episode I'm talking to the conductor Sir Roger Norrington, who gave performances with the orchestra for much of his life until his own retirement in 2021. Our conversation ranged widely, discussing many aspects of his own career while taking the COE as the reference point. I began by asking him whether and how the Chamber Orchestra of Europe is different from the many other bands he's worked with.
I was quite used to what you might call pick-up orchestras because the London Classical Players was picked up, I mean, from quite a few countries, I mean, basically here, but it was the idea of putting an orchestra together with very good players. And in theory, they say, you know, especially in Germany, they say, no, orchestra no good unless it's been years and years together. But actually, in London, we're constantly disproving that because you could put the good players together and they immediately gel. So in that sense, I was quite used to it. But of course, places like Zurich Chamber Orchestra, they're always the same, exactly the same players. But even the Kammerorchester Salzburg, where I was chief for 10 years, they change quite a lot. And they're also very international. It's not unknown, this kind of bringing together of a number of different people. What it does is always make it very fresh and very, people are very interested to be together because they're not, you know, they haven't been sitting next to the same person for the last 15 years and disliking them. It's always exciting when you've got people coming together from far apart. They want to know about each other and they want to play their best for each other.
What do you, what you did, of course, as a conductor was bring together an orchestra for yourself. And this is actually something that British conductors have done a lot ever since Beecham. And really before, of course, back into the 19th century with Charles Halley. But this is a tradition that, has carried on in Britain and is not so true in Germany and France, where they tend to be much more institutional. Yes. And I wonder what that ability to pick and choose who you conduct does for you as a conductor in a way that going to a traditional band doesn't.
Yes. Well, of course, if you've picked them up yourself, it's very personal. And you want to change somebody, a clarinet or a trumpet, then you do so. So it's a great advantage. It is subtly different, but I also like the challenge of working with permanent groups. And of course, when I went to Stuttgart for 15 years, they were solid. They were the same every time I went. So that's also exciting, and you can rely on people in a way that you don't have to teach them so much about playing together. You can concentrate on the style more quickly. So all orchestras are fascinating if they're good. And if they aren't good, it's hell. If they're good and they think they're very good and they're not open to any change, it's also hell. I remember a French cellist, I asked him to do a crescendo at a certain point and he said, Monsieur, c'est pas écrit. It's not written down. I said, no, it's not, but would you do that? No, don't think so. So you do occasionally meet orchestras like that where they simply don't really want to make music, actually. They just want to get paid. But thank goodness they're few and far between.
Now, you were always very famous for going into programmes with great intensity in the way you rehearsed and what you expected out of the players. And indeed, what you expected out of the audience. You didn't like audiences to come uninformed. is that true? Or is it just a reputation that's lived on?
I don't know. Of course, I want the orchestra to know lots about exactly how to play. There's a lot of historical detail, a lot of just musical detail. There are ways of getting an orchestra to play well, which have nothing to do with history at all. They're to do with conducting and the instinct and the skills of conducting. They're absolutely equally important to any sort of historical stuff, the historical stuff just brings excellence to the style of playing. And so it's very important in its way. But as for audiences, we did have these wonderful weekends where we, as it were, taught the audience about the piece and what to expect. And sometimes we engage them in choices. We say, do you prefer it like this or like this? Which is quite fun. And I want an audience to really enjoy the music. I'm always playing for the child who hasn't been to a concert before, or the adult who hasn't been to a concert before. The people at the back, I want them to enjoy it, and I want them to get it. And I do occasionally turn around and see at the end of a movement and see if they are getting it. And indeed, sometimes I encourage applause between the movements, for instance, which was perfectly normal until about 1920. Some critics get very shirty about that. You know, I remember doing it in Salzburg once, and a critic wrote in the paper, "Your conductor should never turn round to the audience, except to tell them to be quiet." I thought that's very Austrian, and I love it when occasionally they just do burst into applause. Even in Berlin, actually, in the Philharmonie, if it's a young audience, after a first movement, they'll sometimes spontaneously burst into applause, and then I'll turn around and thank them, you know, not verbally, I just thank you very much. Or I get up the oboe player who's had a soloist. And then sometimes at the end of the second movement, and there's silence, and I'll turn around to the audience and say, aren't you going to applaud this time? And, I mean, some people think it's terrible.
I didn't like applause after slow movements. I don't mind it after.
No, I mean, what they used to do apparently was, you know, they would loud applause after the first movement, slow movement, there'd be sort of gentle appreciation. It would depend, or there might be silence. I mean, if it was the end of a very, very touching, no, you don't need to. But it was a spontaneous thing, and I love it in an audience.
19th century, the composers would have been really upset if nobody applauded after the first movement, wouldn't they?
Yeah. So would 18th century. I mean, Mozart wrote his concertos so that the end of the first movement, you'd have to have applause. And I should think if they didn't, well, he probably would have walked off.
Yes.
So it's a difficult balance. But I love it, not to praise us on the stage, but to say, we're here, we're enjoying this, and we love this music. It's a special thing when the audience really show their appreciation. They're part of the crew, you know. They're not just in a movie theatre where there is no one on the stage. They're not just sopping it up. They're actually taking part, as it were. And I think it's lovely.
Hooray, the wine is here. the words that start the autumn chorus from Haydn's The Seasons. Sir Roger Norrington and the COE in September 1991, recorded by Deutschlandradio Berlin, released by Profil Edition Gunter Hensler in 2008. Now, with the London Classical Players and the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, you've got two different orchestras, and I just wondered whether the real period instrument sound compared to the classical music played on modern instruments with a period feel. What's the difference for you as the conductor, and what do you think the difference in the sound world is?
Well, the difference in the sound world is slight. The more historically you play modern instruments, the less it matters that the instruments are different. So the answer to the first question is absolutely no difference in the approach. I mean, the approach is exactly the same. Seating, the size of the orchestra, the sound that they make, the speed, everything is exactly the same. The instruments are just a bit different. It's like, a genius pianist sitting down in a pub, and he can make the pub piano sound amazing. We thought when we started the historical movement in the 60s that it was all about instruments, and indeed the instruments taught us a tremendous amount. But when you've learnt those lessons, they're instantly translatable to a violin, which is hardly any different, a trumpet, which is extremely, extremely similar. You end up by realizing the historical movement is not about instruments in the end. It's about your head. You know, it's about what goes on in your head, what you know about how the music did sound and should now sound. So ideally, a modern orchestra would compete on completely equal terms with an old instrument one. And indeed, sometimes I remember playing a piece of Purcell, I think it was, or something quite early, which was played on modern instruments with one of my groups. And I played it to, it was Cat McIntosh or somebody like that, somebody deeply instilled in the early instrument world. And I said, what do you think about this? I put on the tape or whatever it was at the time. And they said, oh, sounds nice. Yeah, early instruments, doesn't it? Of course, yes. And I said nothing. And then after a while, suddenly she said, no, it's a modern instrument, isn't it? I said, yeah, that's what I would like to happen. I mean, if I hear the Stuttgart Orchestra playing Mozart, those wonderful recordings that we made, it just sounds like the best of instruments in the world. And of course, the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, exactly the same. They were extremely well trained by Klaus Harnoncourt. And I've followed up in that line. Of course, he did far more than I did. I did very little, really, with the COE. But one thing I did do was to change the seating. Funnily enough, he never separated the violins. And I remember we had a chat with him somewhere or other when we were both working with the orchestra, perhaps doing different concerts on us same time, somewhere in England, actually. I said, why didn't you change the seating? Because you know that they sat differently. And he said, well, I didn't think they would like it very much. He was too nice to them. I said, well, I thought it was time they did like it. And so after that, they always sat with the violins separated.
That business of antiphonal violins was something, again, that only changed at the beginning of the 20th century, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, Adrian Bolt always had antiphonal violins. He never always changed. Yeah, so did Klemperer, maybe. Certainly Toscanini. So it was just the norm. And funnily enough, Chamber Orchestra of Europe taught Blomstedt about that, because he went as a guest long, long after that, when he was just about to go to Leipzig. And he said, well, why are you sitting like that? I said, well, that's how they used to sit. He said, ooh, because he's a very interesting man. And as soon as he got to Leipzig, he changed the seating there, and he wouldn't allow any conductor to alter it. So that was something that I taught the Chamber Orchestra. They taught Blomstedt, and Blomstedt taught Leipzig. So when I first went to Leipzig, it was in the contract and said, you know, will you accept to play with the violin separate? I said, I wrote back, I think I could manage that.
So the Gewandhaus has actually gone back to its original format, thanks to you.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that's one of the things that's happening now almost all over the world, actually, all sorts of orchestras, Philadelphia, those changes are coming through. And of course, Harnoncourt was extremely influential. He was the governor, you know, he was the boss. We learned a lot from him. from his early recordings of Bach and so on. Very, very important indeed.
You both did that thing of starting an orchestra to actually get your ideas across.
Yes, well, you had to then, really. But so, yeah, the COE plays it a very, very historical way, and it's marvellous as a result. I mean, it's one of the great characteristics of the orchestra.
Niklas Harnoncourt conducting the slow movement, the Andante con moto, of Schubert's Fifth Symphony, recorded at the 1988 Stiriati Festival in Graz and released on ICA Records in 2020. In fact, despite Sir Roger's story, Harnoncourt was already splitting his first and second violins and placing them either side of the stage, but the notion was still regarded as unusual at the time. I wanted to talk about repertoire because when I think of you, when I first watched you conduct, it was as an opera conductor. And I wonder how your focus shifted over the years, or whether, in fact, it was just two sides of the same coin.
The opera and the non-opera, you mean?
Mm.
Yeah, well, I was always involved in both. I mean, you happen to come in onto that side. There are lots of other people who don't know that I've ever conducted an opera, because I haven't done an awful lot since Kent, really. I've only done about three things at Covent Garden and two or three things at Eno, because I was sort of climbing out of opera and into the orchestral world. But, I mean, as a violinist, amateur violinist, I played in lots and lots of orchestral repertoire. So I was completely used to orchestral sound on its own, choirs on their own, small modern ensembles, you know, of 10 or 11 people, and large choir and orchestra and opera. I mean, every single area I've been lucky enough to get my hands dirty in.
And with Chamber Orchestra of Europe, you've conducted some fairly monumental programmes too, not just the smaller scale ones.
Yes, the largest being probably Bremen. In the opening night at Bremen Festival, they have something like 20 different concerts in about five different venues. I was in the Glocke. We did three different programmes, you know, one at 6:30 and one at 8 and one at 9:30 or whatever it was. Not terribly long programmes, but in the cathedral there'd be three other programmes, one after the other, and in a bank there'd be another. and in the Edusho, the coffee warehouse, there'd be another, you know, and the audience could wander from one to the other, you know, and they do. It's absolutely amazing confection. So that first evening, I conducted the Deutsche Kammerphilharmonie, which is very historically aware band. So with the Kammerphilharmonie, I did a Baroque program, the Purcell, Bach, Handel, something like that. And then an hour and a half later, with the COE, I did a classical program, Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven. And in the third concert, with both orchestras sat together, and we played a couple of things, but one of them was Wagner.
Yes, the idea of Wagner arranged Leinsdorf with two glorious orchestras, it sounds, sounds the sort of program that a conductor would thoroughly enjoy.
Yes, I mean, I actually love that collection. It was a joy because it's in one evening I covered my entire repertory. Well, I didn't go back to Jesuel, though, but I mean, from Purcell to Wagner was a wonderful thing to be able to do. And I remember Thomas Albert saying, when he asked me rather late on in the spring to do this thing in the autumn, I said, "Well, I'm not free." He said, "Roger, you've got to be free. You're the only person who can do this program, do it properly." So and we had things like first oboe playing third or fourth oboe in the Wagner. And they all sat next to each other. They were all playing like mad because they were competing with each other in the friendliest way. And they came to watch each other's programs in the previous concerts. I mean, it was a most glorious evening. And then a couple of days later, we did a big concert together of Fantastique. And it was an absolutely splendid week. Both two of my favorite orchestras being together. Let's have more. We have four orchestras.
And the other thing you did a lot in the 1990s with COE was Stravinsky, again, which is something one doesn't associate with your normal classical repertoire.
Well, the sort of Stravinsky that we were doing is fairly classical. I mean, Dumbarton Oaks and Danse Concertante and so on, they're fairly classical, you might say. But I mean, I've also, of course, conducted the Wright and the opera. So, Stravinsky's part of our normal repertoire. I expect to be able to conduct anything that I'm asked to do. You know, I've done 50, 60 world premieres. I've commissioned Nicholas Moore's violin concerto, for instance. For me, that's important to be able to do anything that comes up. I don't do them all as well.
Did you enjoy conducting a big romantic orchestra at times? I remember coming across Chris Hogwood conducting the Los Angeles Phil and the Hollywood Bowl once, doing Rachmaninoff and Grieg, and I wondered whether you enjoyed that sort of grand panoply of romanticism.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yes, I mean, the last thing I did in the Hollywood Bowl was Mahler II. And the Mahler recordings with Stuttgart, I think, are extremely interesting. 1, 2, 4, 5, and 9. All played without vibrato, by the way, because Mahler never heard an orchestra with vibrato. But that's by the way. Big orchestral sound is absolutely fine by me, and so is a Haydn symphony with 6 first violin. Variety is great, you know.
Indeed, and talking of Haydn, I wanted to talk a little bit about Eisenstadt, and because the Chamber Orchestra of Europe is starting a long residency there. What is it like as a conductor to be conducting Haydn in a place where it was first done? I mean, where you have that sense of place and space at the same time.
Yes, it's a wonderful room. The planks of the floor, I suppose they're probably original. They're incredibly wide. They seem to be about half a meter wide, immense. And the sound is great in that hall. Of course, I've also played in Esterhazy up the road, the new castle which Nicholas Esterhazy built, and Haydn was sort of locked up there for years during the summer. So both those places are extremely exciting places to make music. And it's a lovely, and there's Haydn's house in Eisenstadt as well, which is beautifully restored, and it's a museum. Yeah, it's great to be there. I've been there quite a few times, but I think probably only once with COE.
Do you have a sense of the spirit of place when you are actually conducting in those, or is it just another room when you start working?
I think it's just another room in a way. I mean, the one that really sticks out, which also has a Haydn connection, of course, is the Sheldonian Theatre in Oxford. Very unusual shape. And when I think that both Handel and Haydn conducted music in there, it makes me really excited. So that's a special place for me. And we used to live across the road in Trinity. My father was president there. But mostly, you know, you're concentrating on the dots. You're getting the music out. Of course, I just
wonder with that feeling of how you space the orchestra, how they sit, the relationship of the orchestra to the acoustics of the room. Is there any way in which you think of back and you're thinking, looking at the Haydn Symphony, and you're thinking, ah, now I see why he did it like that?
Well, you certainly get it with the violins opposite each other, don't you? I've been experimenting with having all the woodwinds standing in a circle around the strings, which is very satisfying. And it could be how they played in London in 1791-5. That's something that works incredibly well. All our Haydns in Stuttgart were recorded like that. And I think COE, we played like that the last time, with the strings sitting not in 2x2x2x2, but sitting in two, like if you have 8 first violins, you have 4 in the front row and 4 in the second row. So the first violins are incredibly close together. Across the aisle, 8 second violins, also very close together. The ensemble is wonderful. And behind that stand this row of wind and brass and timpani. And the double basses are right at the back in the center, right behind the violas and cellos. So that works incredibly well. It's very, very much a feeling of large chamber music. It shrinks the orchestra to me, and I can do as little as possible and just stand on the ground, not have a podium at all. And of course, not a music stand either. Haydn's music is much too demanding not to be played from memory, not to be conducted from memory. You've got to think so quickly that you haven't got time to look at a score.
Did you ever direct from the harpsichord?
No, because I don't play the keyboard.
Oh, right.
I would love to have been able to do that. I mean, that would be... there was no conductor in Esterházy, for instance. Haydn, we think, was leading the second violins, and the Italian virtuoso would be leading the first violins just across, and they were standing. Of course, that was a little bit smaller than the COE. At Esterházy, there were 3 first violins, 3 second violins, 1 viola, 1 cello and 1 bass. So it was pretty small, but for that room it was tiny, of course. But there wasn't a conductor. Conductors came in Beethoven's time. They discovered they really needed one with Beethoven 9. That was the one which, as it were, demanded to be conducted. And people conducted big oratorios and so on.
Going back almost 30 years, you conducted Chamber Orchestra of Europe. I was wondering, what are the programmes that you remember with particular fondness?
Yes, well, the two which I remember with absolute fondness are the two Haydn oratorios in Berlin, the Schöpfung in 1990 in the Berlin Festival, and a year later with the same cast, same 3 singers, wonderful singers, and the Reas Corps, who are good friends of mine, the Jahreszeiten, the seasons. They were very special. We had to play them in the small chamber music hall because the big one was being redone for asbestos, and so it was closed for about a year. So we crammed into the small hall, and I remember I ended up with the basses behind me, with their backs to the audience, and I was in the middle with the wonderful fortepiano pianist John Toll. Marvellous. You can hear him on the recording. Absolutely brilliant little interventions from the fortepiano. And this marvellous cast of Oates, Scott Weir and Peter Lika. Fabulous cast. Excellent chorus. The orchestra was wonderful. The audience, in this tidy hall with the audience almost all around us, were ecstatic. It was quite wonderful. And a year later, we did it all again. And they were both broadcast, these concerts. And about 10 years ago, years later, a friend of mine who collects all my strange old radio recordings, his self-appointed archivist, and he's got recordings of things I didn't even know I conducted, you know, La Vestale in Paris in 1972. I don't have any recollection of it. And he found this radio recording and listened to them. He said they're marvelous. And he spoke to a record company, and we all agreed to put it out. It's absolutely live, one performance. They're an absolute joy to listen to. I can't imagine better performances of those two pieces. The other day, I was working with Sally, cellist Sally Pendlebury, and I said, well, we've met before, haven't we? She said, yeah, Chamber Orchestra of Europe. She said, I remember the Schöpfung in Berlin. She said, it was the best concert I ever played in. Just very sweet. So there was something very, very special about those two occasions, and they're my favourite memory. I think the orchestra is absolutely marvellous, and I'm bitterly regret that I didn't do more with them.
Sir Roger Norrington recounting a conversation with Sally Pendlebury, a long-time cellist member of the COE. Let's finish with that performance of The Creation, the final chorus sung by Rias Chamber Choir Berlin in March 1990 and released by Profil Edition Günter Hensler in 2008.